versus Jefferson County Bank. We have first appearing Sean Duffy representing Mr. Musa. Mr. Duffy.
May it please the court, counsel, guests. We have a case here with rather complex facts that's been in the court system for nigh on a decade. And it's all boiled down to a fairly simple issue. I won't belabor the facts, but allow me to take a moment to just hit the highlights to put in context our argument. Mr. Frank Musa, our client, bought a hotel restaurant in Jefferson, Wisconsin with a mortgage from the Jefferson County Bank. James Buell, the respondent, was the bank officer in charge of that loan. Mr. Musa renovated the property and was heralded in Jefferson for his efforts at rejuvenating the town. After this renovation, he wanted to sell the bank, but he needed, or the hotel, but he needed the bank's permission because of a due on sale clause in the mortgage that says the bank has to approve in order to allow the buyer to assume the mortgage. Mr. Musa tried to sell the hotel to a number of prospective buyers, sending each of them to Mr. Buell, and including Mr. Alou, whose claim is really the crux of this case. Mr. Buell would not give the bank's consent. In fact, he refused to meet with Mr. Alou, and evidence showed that he told other potential buyers that Mr. Musa was a shady character whose word was no good. There was other evidence that Mr. Buell wanted the hotel sold instead to a cousin of his, instead of the, in his words, foreigners that Mr. Musa was dealing with. Ultimately, Mr. Musa lost the hotel in foreclosure, causing him great financial hardship, rendering him unable to repay a loan given by a relative, and causing him severe anxiety and depression. He was treated for that over the course of years with psychotherapy and prescription medications and incurred bills of around $4,000. Mr. Musa sued the bank and Mr. Buell.
Counsel, in the record, as long as we're talking about these bills, the appellate court indicated that that part of the record was not available for their reviews in their decision. Is this something you're talking about that's in the record as far as the time and the bills? I'm just referring to their opinion, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
I am. I don't understand. I really don't understand the Court of Appeals reference in that instance because in the record, and I'm trying to find the reference here. Record 197, Exhibit 38, was a Phoenix mental health bill. It was provided to the Court of Appeals by way of our brief on reconsideration after the Court of Appeals withdrew their first brief, withdrew their first decision and ordered further briefing and oral argument. We provided it to the Court of Appeals in our appendix, and it lays out treatment from 1993 to 1997 in the total amount of $4,095.
Now, my question is, in the record, it shows that the reference to what you're talking about with Mr. Musa and their relationship was back in 1982 to 1984, I believe, according to the Court of Appeals. Is that... That's what I'm referring to.
That's, I don't have the exact dates. I could certainly look up the exact dates, but it is that era.
So you're referring to mental health or bills that came out in the late, you mean as late as 1997?
There was, in the doctor's report, it indicated, 1997 is as late as the bill goes,
yes.
Correct.
But they were put in the 90s.
And the doctor, it's all in the 90s. The doctor's report said she first met Mr. Musa in 1990. The only medical bills we submitted were from 93 to 97. Those were the only ones that were provided to the court.
In the transaction, and I don't want to belabor this, but just so I understand that when, and this is in your petitioner's brief and appendix, and I'm just referring to the Court of Appeals decision there, that, from briefs on post-verdict motions, we learned that the psychiatrist testified for the defense on the possible causes, but we have no transcript of that testimony. Finally, if Musa did have any treatment providers, there is no transcript of such testimony.
Oh, now I understand. Now I understand what you're referring to. There was no issue on this appeal as to the factual basis for the medical bill award. That wasn't the basis of the trial court's decision, so no testimony from the medical providers was transcribed and provided to the Court of Appeals. That's correct. The Court of Appeals did have medical reports from Mr. Musa's treating therapist and also an independent report from Dr. Marshall at UW, basically echoing.
Not to belabor the point, but on 125, it's page 11 of the decision, they go on to say, and this is what a portion of the record at that time, which does not persuade us there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find at that time Velo interfered with the prospective sale to Alou, that it was reasonably foreseeable, and then they talk about the, that's what I was referring to, the billings and the record itself.
Mike, that, what's the date on the decision you're referring to?
I think that's the August 12th, 19th, the first opinion.
First opinion, yeah. That's also in, okay.
That's the first opinion when the Court of Appeals was concerned with.
I have it labeled the first opinion.
Okay. At that time, the Court of Appeals was concerned with the foreseeability of those medical bills because that was the basis on which the trial court had struck them down. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court on other grounds, also foreseeability-based, dating from a different date. So the court was looking for information to support the foreseeability of those bills. Then it withdrew that decision, gave us a chance for more briefing, and that's when we provided the, when we called the court's attention to the documents I just referenced.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly.
Mr. Duffy, let me ask you, if I understand this correctly, there was a 98-question verdict, is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Was there any objection by a counsel at the trial level to the form of the verdict?
The verdict was the result of hours of jury instruction conference over the course of several days. There may have been objections to bits and pieces of it, but I think it was a collaborative effort as far as how it would be presented. Specifically, I don't know if I assume what the court is referencing is separate damage questions for each of the three causes of action. Basically a collaborative effort between the court and counsel in how to present three separate causes of action as to five separate lost sales. In other words, two causes of action against the bank and one cause of action against Bulow for each of five sales. There may hypothetically have been a better way to present it, but this is the best that we came up with, and I don't think there was any specific objection by counsel to how it was presented. It was a collaborative.
And you're not raising any objection now then to the verdict form?
No, I think it was done as well as could be done under the circumstances given the claims that we had to present to the jury.
This case may be simple for you. I'm having a little trouble with it. And it just strikes me that I'm going to try and just simplify the issue before us, and maybe I've got it all wrong, and you'll correct me. The fight really is here about the $50,000.
As a practical matter?
Yes.
Certainly, because there's no objection to the $50,000.
Well, the $50,000 was punitive damages, right?
Correct.
And to get punitive damages, you have to have some underlying damages.
Correct.
And your underlying damage here is the
$4,000. $4,000, or we argue the $385,000.
I understand that. But let's, for the moment, do the $4,000. So you're really fighting about the $4,000 to get the $50,000.
As a practical matter, yes.
Okay. And the other part of this case is that you're going to fight about the $385,000 because that you want as a basis for your $50,000 if you can't do it on the $4,000.
I believe the court can certainly do that.
Well, I have a note here that this argument about the $385,000, a similar issue, is being raised in a December case, McKenzie v. Miller Brewing Company. Are you aware of that?
Is that the Seinfeld case? I read the decision. I can't recall that exact issue being presented. I read the lower decision.
All right. I'll just leave that. All right. Now, since we're fighting about the punitive damages, just let's get to the basis. What's your attack? Is your attack that we should get rid of the rule that you need substantial damages to get punitive damages? You could.
Get rid of compensatory damages as a basis?
Yeah. Is that your attack?
No.
Okay. So now you've got to get compensatory, right? Damages. You've got substantial damages. It doesn't say compensatory, consequential, or whatever the...
We did get them. We're trying to get them back.
Pardon me?
We did get them. We're trying to get them back.
Okay. All right. So what is the $4,000? Is this the medicals?
Correct.
Okay, the $4,000 are medicals, and medicals are generally viewed as consequential.
Special damages, the three categories of damages allowable for intentional infliction of or intentional interference with contract are pecuniary loss, consequential damages, and emotional distress. Medical bills fit under consequential. That's the only place they fit.
Okay. The Court of Appeals did not agree with that. They found that these were akin to emotional distress damages.
They certainly are treating them like emotional distress damages for the purposes of the substantial other damage.
So isn't your argument to us, your attack, in the words of the Chief, the attack is that these are not emotional distress damages, these are consequential damages, and therefore there is no requirement that there be substantial other damages, and therefore you
get your $50,000.
Absolutely. That's been our position from day one, and I'd love the opportunity to outline what I think are the differences between emotional distress and medical bills for the purposes of this.
Before you do that, on the special verdict, which is on page 145 of your brief, question number 6, make sure I'm at the right one. This deals with MUSA. And is this the one we're looking at? Anyway, emotional distress, the jury gave 0.
Correct.
Anywhere the jury give emotional distress? On page 148, it's consequential, 4,000. Seems to be the same $4,000, right?
I think there was a thought that there might be, that might be legal bills that were...
On the second one, that's not before us.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, there is, back on question number 48.
I haven't gotten it yet. Okay, that's on page...
And it's page 157 of our appendix.
Got it. Emotional distress is $25,000, so it's not $4,000. To whom does that question go? To Jefferson County Bank or to...
That goes to Jefferson County Bank.
Okay, but we're not... The bank isn't in this case, right?
Correct. They've paid their money and...
All right.
And left. And...
So that's the only place there's emotional distress. So what is the Court of Appeals doing, saying that the verdict is incorrect?
They're saying, my understanding is... that they're extending the rule of Anderson versus Continental Insurance to say the substantial other damage requirement shouldn't only apply to emotional distress damages, but also with similar strength to medical treatment for that emotional distress based on the same rationale. That's the Court of Appeals That's the Court of Appeals holding. Muse obviously disagrees for several reasons. We believe there's a fundamental
difference. Before we get into those reasons, I just need one more fact to cover. Was the, in as much as it appears anyway, that you're not arguing that this $4,000 was for medical costs associated with the mental problems, was that $4,000 in fact the amount that Mr. Musa had to pay the doctors for his treatment?
$4,095 was the exhibit given to the jury, the exhibit introduced at trial.
So you concede that $4,000 is for the medical expenses for emotional distress.
Everyone agrees. Everyone has agreed from trial court to today.
What I would like you, as an extension of these questions, to focus on is this. Look, medical bills, what they call out-of-pockets, are specials. They've been specials forever. You don't have to at least convince me that they're generally anything but specials, which are distinct from the pain and suffering, which are distinct from the mental distress and anxiety that you get in your general. The problem is this, and I think it was set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion primarily around paragraph 14. They say, okay, sure, it might be different, but in this context, when we're dealing with Anderson-like cases, that when we're dealing with the mental distress, intentional interference with the contract, that the rationale of Anderson is diluted. The rationale of Anderson is just thrown out the window if for this particular kind of case they are not treated one and the same. That's what I understand paragraph 14 to be. So generally they're different, and so I don't think you need to tell us that they're different. I might be wrong. I'm speaking for me. But in this context, they're saying they're the same because logically they are the same. It's a logical extension. That's what I need. Why is this, in this context, make what normally is specials or doesn't make what normally is specials? That's what I was saying.
And I don't think they are. I mean, obviously, the Court of Appeals thinks they are. I think they aren't because of, well, for two reasons. Number one, the courts have already, in a bad faith case following Anderson, in the Poling versus Wisconsin Physician Service case, they've already treated payment of medical bills as this substantial other damages, not as emotional distress damages, but rather as substantial other damages in support of an emotional distress award. In that case,
bills for mental health treatment?
They were bills for treatment for Alzheimer's. For the plaintiff paid nursing home bills for treatment of his wife for Alzheimer's. The insurance company wouldn't pay, saying she was only getting custodial care, not medical care. Ultimately, the insurance company was proved wrong. They were sued in bad faith. The jury awarded $35,000 for bad faith damages as an element. That's the only thing it says in the opinion. The insurance company says we shouldn't have allowed that, the court shouldn't have allowed that because there was no evidence of substantial other damages. The Court of Appeals said there's evidence of, first, emotional distress, because they brought in evidence from his doctor, etc. Then they said there's evidence of substantial other damages because he depleted his life savings paying for these bills that the insurance company wouldn't pay. Now, that is payment of medical expenses as substantial other damages. That's as close as the courts of the state have gotten to that. They haven't answered this exact question. If they had, the case probably wouldn't have gotten this far. But that's as close as they've gotten, and when they've gotten close, they've called medical expenses closer to substantial other damages than emotional distress damages. That's one reason. I think it's contrary to Wisconsin law. Another reason is the very nature of medical bills as opposed to emotional distress damages. We all know that the courts of this state have long been hesitant about awarding emotional distress damages And in the Bowen case, this court said that's for two reasons generally. Number one, we have to establish the authenticity of the plaintiff's claim. And number two, we have to put reasonable limits on the defendant's potential liability. Well, in our position, these concerns are not raised by a medical bill award such as the one to Mr. Musa. When you're talking about authenticity of the claim, while emotional distress damages can be awarded without any expert support, medical bills can only be awarded if an expert comes in and vouches for their reasonableness and necessity. While emotional distress damages only require the plaintiff to say on the witness stand, I had emotional distress, medical bills, in this case especially, required the plaintiff to go to the doctor over a course of years to endure psychological poking and prodding, in this case to take psychological medications, and to incur bills that at the time he couldn't afford. So that's how this claim's authenticated. As far as limited liability, while emotional distress damages are notoriously difficult to calculate, and the courts have said that again and again, and they're essentially by that nature unlimited, medical bills are easy to calculate and by their very nature limited and known to the defendant before trial.
That's the problem that the Court of Appeals had. They said that presumably, I mean, if you go to Amgen proof of damages, you're going to have, you know, very different questions to ask for mental distress and for the medical bills associated with treatment for mental distress. I mean, there's differences, but the Court of Appeals is concerned, and it says that presumably, again, paragraph 14, 110 of an index, presumably this would require proof that the interference caused severe emotional distress which caused the plaintiff to seek treatment. Therefore, the jury, this is the sentence, therefore the jury must still evaluate the proof on the causation, existence, and severity of emotional distress in order to award damages for the treatment costs. So they're saying they're inextricably intertwined in this kind of a cause of action.
All plaintiff need prove when he or she is seeking medical expenses is that it was reasonable for him to seek those medical expenses. Same in this case. I mean, the evidence showed that he went from the top of the heap in Jefferson to not being able to pay his bills. His reputation went from, you know, savior of downtown to someone whose word you can't trust. He had anxiety, depression, serious enough for the doctor to give him medications. In that case, I don't think that the Court of Appeals concerns are justified. We have to agree to disagree, because I think that when the jury is given this evidence, it can certainly find that it was reasonable for Frank Musa to have sought the medical treatment that he sought, and that's the only thing the jury has to decide in order to award it. And I point out in the Yonke case, you can get medical bills for a condition even if you get no award for the condition itself, for pain and suffering itself. I mean, you can have an injury that causes you pain and suffering, go to the doctor, the jury is free to award you the medical bills from the doctor without giving you any award for the pain and suffering, because it didn't feel it was worth it, really.
That's what it did here. It didn't give you any damages for emotional distress.
And the jury was told that Frank Musa not only could, but had a duty to mitigate his emotional distress damages by seeking reasonable treatment. So here he seeks the reasonable treatment, and now the bills are taken away from him. I mean, the jury did exactly what they were supposed to do. If they found that Mr. Musa had sought reasonable treatment and gave him compensation for that, and found that that had mitigated his emotional distress damages, they were free not to award for emotional distress, thereby protecting Mr. Bulow from unlimited liability for emotional distress damages that so concerned the court over the past six decades or so.
Could I ask you, the jury awarded $385,000 pecuniary damages against the bank.
it awarded zero pecuniary damages against Mr. Buehler. Why?
The jury was told not to duplicate, as every jury is told, not to duplicate damage awards on more than one space. And this is where perhaps there may have been other ways to draft this verdict, but I don't know of any better ways, working with what we had. So the only way to present this case to the jury, the damage claims to the jury, was on good faith claim against the bank, what were the damages? On intentional interference against the bank, what were the damages? And on intentional interference against Buehler, what were the damages?
What was the evidence on the medical expenses? How? What did you offer? $4,095?
$4,000 in bills and medical reports and...
Well, then why is it then that the jury awarded $4,000 in medical expenses against the bank and $4,000 against Mr. Buehler?
There was also some talk of legal expenses he had incurred. The court had decided that they were subject to the American rule, it couldn't be collected. The parties, I guess, assumed that $4,000 might have been toward legal expenses instead.
Can I ask one other question? On page 145 of your brief, question 5, the answer is yes, and then that's scratched out, and no is put in. Is there any indication of when the yes was scratched out?
Certainly before the verdict was returned, but beyond that, no.
Very good. But could subsequent questions have been answered before that yes was scratched out and no put in?
That's all within the black box of the jury room. I can't tell you how the jury attacked their case. I know that, I mean, I'm a political science major way back when, and when we went through survey classes, we were told that if you ask a bunch of questions and they all call for one answer, you can get a person to get into a response set where they're more likely to answer that way. And I can only say that the four questions before that all called for a yes answer to award damages against Mr. Buehler. This one was the first one to call for a no answer in order to sustain the case. It may have been just the jury of being in a response to that, no matter.
Could I ask one other question?
Go ahead.
What is the quick answer, if there is one? Why didn't you have a transcript of the entire, everything?
It was expensive and unnecessary. It was a long trial, and the basis for the court's decision really made the transcript irrelevant. There was nothing in the transcript that would have helped one way or another the Court of Appeals decide whether the trial court was correct in its ruling or not, because the trial court only ruled on a legal issue, never attacked the factual basis for the jury's decisions. In fact, specifically found that all the jury's answers were well-founded in fact, and essentially granted judgment notwithstanding the verdict for a purely legal question that turned a legal issue that turned out to be a contract principle rather than a tort principle. That's why the Court of Appeals had to affirm on different grounds. Any other questions?
No. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Attorney Neumeier, you represent the defendant, James Buehler.
Yes, I do. May it please the court, I'd like to say good morning to the court, to counsel, and to guests here in the courtroom today. I normally don't spend a whole lot of time addressing the facts of a case in oral argument either, but I think some of that is warranted in this case. A couple of weeks ago, I was reading the Wisconsin Opinion's newspaper, and to my chagrin, there was a synopsis of this case in that newspaper, and the headline to the case read something like "The Case of the Bigoted Banker."
I'm sorry, say that again.
The headline to the synopsis in the Wisconsin Opinion's article that I was reading read "The Case of the Bigoted Banker." And to a certain extent, we've heard
for the microphone.
Case of the bigoted banker. That's the headline. Okay.
Josh, you repeated it three times, but don't want anyone to hear it.
To a certain extent, in Mr. Duffy's recitation of facts today, we've heard similar things. I've addressed these issues in my brief, in my statement of facts, but it's important for the court to know what the jury did and did not find. This is not a case about a bigoted banker. Neither is this a case about a devious plot by Mr. Bielow to keep the Jefferson House out of the hands of foreigners or for his own relatives. This is a case where the jury found Mr. Bielow to have interfered with a contract simply by telling a gentleman that called him on the telephone, "I'm sorry, you're too new in town, I can't help you." The other reading of the outcome of this trial based on the jury's verdict, I think, is simply wrong. Now, Mr. Duffy did point out that it was evidence presented at trial that Mr. Bielow had told someone that Mr. Musa was a shady character and that his word was no good. I can tell the court that those statements were made to a woman named Betty Kent, whose contract was one of the five contracts at issue in this case. Well, if the court looks at the jury instruction, their special verdict form, when it gets to the questions relating to Ms. Kent, there was a specific question asked about whether Mr. Bielow in any way disparaged or defamed Mr. Musa to her, and the jury answered that question no.
Counsel, help me with this if you can. The Court of Appeals issued two opinions, and the first opinion, the August opinion, address the issue of foreseeability and the timing of foreseeability at the time the contract was entered or at the time of the alleged interference. I mean, that was, and throughout that opinion, in footnote and in text, many times complained that we don't have the full record. However, that opinion was withdrawn, and that opinion indicated that the issue that we are dealing with here today, and the way that oftentimes opinions do that, a withdrawn opinion, said we're going to address foreseeability, and now on this legal issue, footnote, we need not address that legal issue because we're responding on foreseeability. Just the flip has happened now. Now they issue a new opinion that says we're doing it on this issue of, are these medical expenses really emotional distress? And then footnote, and thus we need not address the issue of foreseeability. Okay. My question is, with that by way of preface, number one, are we lacking anything in the transcript? I don't see the Second Court of Appeals opinion really complaining of that on this issue of, arguably, of whether mental of medical expenses here constitute mental distress. Are we missing anything on the transcript on this one?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I think we are. Mr. Duffy made a statement that there's no question in this case that there was testimony that the medical expenses or the mental health treatment expenses, maybe I'll phrase it that way, that Mr. Musa incurred were reasonable and necessary. Unfortunately, that specific testimony doesn't exist in the record because we don't have a record before.
But is that being contested? Well, was it contested at trial?
It was not contested at trial.
Okay. So the reason I stopped you here is I hear you going into the background of facts and maybe saying this was said and this not said. And my sense is that may have been important if you addressed this case on foreseeability as the first opinion did. But the dispute of facts and what was foreseeable and when really isn't important if you address it the way the Court of Appeals did on the second opinion and as I understand the cases being presented to us today. Am I right or wrong on that?
I understand what you're saying. I don't believe you're right. I don't believe that the issue of foreseeability is not before this court.
What issue is it on foreseeability? In your brief, where did you...
And I did address that in my last brief to the Supreme Court, briefly at page 7. The headline that reads, damages for mental health counseling expenses in a tortious interference with a contract case are subject to a rule of foreseeability. My reading of...
I mean, I see that as being, is that one page or two pages of discussion. I didn't really see that as the issue before us here today, since the Court of Appeals opinion didn't address foreseeability.
Well, I don't think the fact that the Court of Appeals didn't address it necessarily means that it's not before this court, because the court said, well, we're not addressing that issue because we're deciding on different grounds. So I think in order to protect my client, I had to address that at least briefly in my brief to keep the issue alive here today. And given your comments, I do think that the record is lacking, because there is no record evidence before the court upon which this court could make a determination that either emotional distress damages or mental health treatment expenses, if they are subject to a rule of foreseeability, were foreseeable.
It isn't. Are you contesting? Did you contest at trial that the $4,000 was reasonable and necessary? Did you contest that at trial?
Don't recall specifically, but I don't believe so.
Did you preserve that on appeal?
Don't believe so. But in at least in terms of foreseeability, I do believe that that there is a foreseeability requirement for mental health treatment expenses akin to the foreseeability requirement for emotional distress damages. And on that basis, I think the court could conclude that the result of both the trial court and the Court of Appeals should be upheld because there is no record before the court on it.
Because there's what?
Because there's no record before the court on that issue.
Do we need a record on that?
On foreseeability, I think you do, because that is a factual finding.
But isn't it reasonably foreseeable that if you do a wrong to somebody, you may cause mental problems?
I don't believe that it is, especially in a breach of contract case.
Or cost them $385,000.
Well, the problem is Mr. Velo didn't specifically, the claim that resulted in the $385,000 of damages was not a claim against Mr. Velo.
But it was because of Mr. Velo's actions, wasn't it?
That's another area where I think lack of a record in this case is problematic. Mr. Duffy, in his brief, has pointed out that each and every act by Mr. Velo in this case was also the act of a bank, and that's not quite true. For instance, I would point to there was a separate contract involving a gentleman named Mr. Islami. The jury determined that Mr. Velo did not interfere with that contract, but the jury determined that the bank did breach its duty of good faith. Similarly, with respect to another contract, the Shane Hart Garopoulos contract, and I think that was the last one listed in the special verdict form, there was no claim against Mr. Velo at all with respect to that transaction, and the jury found that the bank breached that duty of good faith as well.
Well, with respect to the claim that's before us, sir, Aluli, is that how you pronounce it?
I believe it's Alu.
Alu, okay. With respect to Mr. Alu, was there anybody else involved other than Mr. Velo?
There was evidence at trial. There was testimony presented by the other officers of the bank. There was testimony presented by other employees of the bank. My feeling, Your Honor, is that the thrust of that testimony and the argument that Mr. Duffy or Mr. Duffy and Mr. Schultz made at trial was that it was that conduct it was Mr. Bilo's conduct which also constituted the bank's breach. But we don't know that because we don't have a record. I don't specifically recall what those other witnesses testified to at trial, but I think it's conceivable that the jury may have based its finding that the bank had breached its duty of good faith on evidence other than the statement by Mr. Bilo, "I'm sorry, you're too new in town, I can't help you." So I think that's another problem that the lack of a record in this case presents.
Well, if we should find that, in fact, these consequential losses of $4,000 was not emotional distress, not akin to emotional distress, and therefore they should, and therefore we reverse the Court of Appeals on that, are you suggesting that we should send this back? And what can we do?
Well, I think that's one option the court has.
Send it back to whom?
And for what?
Yeah.
Well, I think it would have to go back to... the Court of Appeals. where the Court of Appeals could have a complete record before it.
Is there a complete record available in the trial court?
I believe there is. The transcripts have not been prepared, but my suspicion is that they could still be available to be prepared.
That gets me back to my question. I still don't fully understand. If there are different issues, but if the court decides this issue based on the Court of Appeals opinion, which arguably is the reason we took the case because of the Court of Appeals opinion, and that opinion addressed the issue, as I understand it, primarily of and rested on that these medical expenses are are not specials, but are emotional distress for purposes of this interference with the contract claim. I mean, that's a pure legal question.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I agree with you on that score. If the court decides this case on those grounds, favorably to Mr. Bulow, I don't think we need to talk about records or evidence of trial, because I think they are legal questions.
Let me ask you if this is the right legal questions to ask in this case. I'm going to set it out in what I think the law is, but I can be wrong. That you can't get emotional distress generally in Wisconsin law, except for intentional infliction of emotional distress. You cannot get damages for emotional distress unless you have other damages, substantial other damages, right?
Right, and there are several other requirements as well for emotional distress damages.
Okay. Two, if you want punitive damages, you've got to have something other than emotional distress. You have to have other damages than emotional distress.
Still with you, yes.
Okay. And what the Court of Appeals here said was, you don't have other damages. You don't have emotional distress damages, per se, but you have medical expenses for emotional distress. Therefore, they're equivalent. These medical expense damages are equivalent to emotional distress damages. You don't have anything else, any other damages. Therefore, you can't get punitive damages.
I think that's a fair reading of what the Court of Appeals is saying.
Okay. So it seems to me the issue before us is whether those steps are true.
Well, I think the issue, I think so, and I think I'll state it a different way. I think the issue before the court is, should the very same requirements that apply to the recoverability of emotional distress damages also apply to the recoverability of mental health treatment expenses that are intended to mitigate those damages?
It sounds the same to me. Now I'm going to go one step further. The argument is made that 774A of the restatement lists as a potential damage emotional distress. So the argument goes, I think, that if emotional distress is one of the recognized damages in this tort of intentional interference with a contract or business relationship, that it's okay to get medical damages for the emotional distress, that it may be one and the same, and that since it is part of the recognized damages for this tort, you therefore should be able to support a punitive damage result also, similar to what you do in a intentional infliction of emotional distress. Is that the argument?
If I understand you correctly,
you're saying... You can restate it. That's okay.
Maybe I missed something. You're saying that since the restatement says that emotional distress damages are available, and because punitive damages are available for intentional torts when there are emotional distress damages, you're saying that by logic, punitive damages should be available for intentional interference with the contract.
I'm saying, because otherwise I don't understand the paragraph in the trying to make sense out of the statement in the Court of Appeals decision that says we seem to be inconsistent with 774A. Look at page 111 on the blue brief. We are convinced that the Anderson requirement of substantial other damages must logically be applied both to general damages of emotional distress and to damages for costs of mental health treatment. We acknowledge that this may be inconsistent with the formulation of damages for the tort of intentional interference with a contract or prospective contractual relation in 774A. And it goes on to say we've never adopted 774A.
I think the Court of Appeals there was saying probably more than it had to. In this one respect, I think I disagree with the Court of Appeals, and that is that the requirement of substantial other damages for mental health treatment expenses is inconsistent with the restatement. The restatement simply doesn't address that issue. And I think in that respect, it's a lot like not addressing that issue with respect to general emotional distress damages, which clearly applies in Wisconsin under the Anderson case.
Well, you know, I have a little trouble with the Anderson case. The Anderson case is 1978. It's almost a quarter of a century ago. The court at that time was dealing with a whole set of cases that go back a lot of years, maybe 100, that are not friendly to emotional distress because they view emotional distress as potentially fraud-based. And so what you see in the Anderson case, it's one of the early cases where the court is starting to move away from so much suspicion of emotional distress and starting to recognize this concept. And also you've got punitive damages, which are suspect because they're so heavy. And when you add the two, and then you got bad faith, which is also a relatively new cause of action at that time, and suspect. So the court adds a lot of requirements and criteria. And in its holding on page 695, it really has a very narrow holding and says, in bad faith cause of action against an insurance company, we conclude that to recover for emotional distress in the absence of pleading and proof that there was an intentional infliction of emotional distress, the plaintiff must plead and prove substantial damages aside from emotional distress and damages occasioned by the simple breach. And then it goes on to punitive damage. So it's a very narrow reading for bad faith. It's not a very broad holding. I guess it's been taken out of that context in other cases. I mean, what do we need all of these layers and layers and layers of
protections? I don't think there are layers and layers. I think there are two or three special protections. And I think those protections exist because of the reasons that the Anderson Court put them into place. I think substantial progress has been made in the field of mental health over the last 5 or 10 years. For instance, with respect to the treatment of depression, it's a much more scientific field now. But
and it's recognized that more and more people suffer from depression
mental
ailments.
The problem is, Justice Abramson, I think the field of mental health is still very subjective. And this is where we get to one of the differences I wanted to point out, and that is that there is, a qualitative difference between medical expenses and mental health treatment expenses, even with all of the advances in mental health treatment over the years. I think mental health illness and problems are still very subjective, even though it's getting better. And I think on balance, physical illnesses and injuries are much more objective. And I think for those reasons, there's still a need for some special protections in the case of mental illness against fraudulent claims. Now, I'm not standing here saying that Mr. Musa was making up his need for mental health treatment. What I'm saying is that there's a danger of that in every case, and you should have to prove the requisites to get mental health treatment expenses before you get them. I'm not saying he's making it up. I'm just saying there's a danger of that happening unless the requirements are met. The requirements were not met.
Suppose he had $100,000 medical care for his mental issue, mental problems. Would that make you feel better about a punitive damages of $50,000?
No, not if the court didn't award any emotional distress damages or any other damages related to the breach of contract.
It would make me feel better. It would give me the sense that there were really damages here. $4,000 is, you know, a few hours of some doctor's work and pills. It's probably pretty expensive about pills.
That actually brings up a point I wanted to make earlier. Justice Babich, I think, asked Mr. Duffy whether Mr. Musso was in fact...
Counsel, if you'd stand in front of the microphone, I'm sorry. Otherwise, we can't tape you.
He's reaching for a document. And I
go ahead. Reach for the document and don't talk.
Justice Babich, I think, earlier asked Mr. Duffy whether Mr. Musso was actually out of pocket $4,000 for his mental health treatment expenses. And if the court takes a close look at the exhibit he pointed to, and that's Record Item 197, Exhibit 38, these are the medical bills we're talking about. We were prevented at trial from arguing to the jury that Mr. Musso's damages should be reduced based on the fact that he didn't pay out of pocket all of those medical expenses. We were barred from arguing that by the collateral source rule. There was,
right.
There was a motion that we did not...
So his insurance company might have been out.
Right.
And they might have been able to be subrogated.
Right. I don't think the collateral source rule, however, prevents me from arguing here that because Mr. Musso did not pay out of pocket those damages, that shouldn't be something the court takes into consideration in determining whether these are substantial other damages. And if the court looks at the exhibit...
Hold it, I'm sorry. Finish the answer.
If the court looks at the exhibit, and I spent some time going through it yesterday, the court will note that Mr. Musso was out of pocket about $2 for each session he had, for a total of $58. The rest was paid either by Medicaid or was simply wiped off the books as a Medicaid disallowance. So I think to argue that $4,000 is substantial damage is a little disingenuous because Mr. Musso wasn't out of pocket that amount. Now, we couldn't argue that to the jury, but I think we can argue that to this court because substantial other damages is a legal concept that this court has to make. Those facts are in the record, and I just don't think $58 out of pocket gets us there.
Counsel, although we kind of discounted foreseeability because of the second opinion, and you do have it in your brief, I realize the relationship, you're not arguing that these eight, they did occur. As I recall this case, the conversation occurred somewhere between 82 and 84, but the bills that we're talking about, particularly Exhibit 38, is that relating to 93 to 97?
If I understand your... Well, I don't know that I understand your question.
Well, the question I have is that there was an alleged statement made in 82 to 84 dealing with the unsuitability of the business venture or the person that may be purchasing, and then the bills for the mental distress happened from 93 to 97. That's what your opposing counsel indicated.
I believe so. I think the acts that formed the basis of the claim occurred mid to early 80s, and then we're talking about mental health treatment starting in 93. Now, the problem with foreseeability is if Mr. Musso did in fact make the statements that the jury found he made in 1980, whatever the year was, 1984, could he have foreseen that would cause Mr. Musso to seek mental health treatment in 1993. I think we're, in terms of time, getting a little far out of field there. Maybe I'll leave foreseeability now and talk about other things.
No, I understand that.
Sure. because I don't think foreseeability is the focus of this court today, so I would like to move on to a few other things.
Could I ask a question? We have a trial with two defendants, or maybe three defendants. May we accept the fact that $385,000 in pecuniary damages was awarded against the bank, or is that, or can't be accepted?
Can you accept the fact that $385,000 was awarded against the bank? I'm not sure I understand what you're getting at here.
I thought I read somewhere that the bank is not before us. I thought I read somewhere that there were post-trial motions by the bank. I mean, is that money still there, or is that evaporated? Or
I don't believe this is in the record, so I'm not real comfortable talking about it, but my understanding is that the bank did not appeal that item of damages, that $385,000, and that the bank has already paid those damages to Mr. Musso.
Why can't those damages be used as the basis for the punitive damages?
Well, there are several reasons. And I've addressed this fairly thoroughly in my brief, so I'll hit the highlights. First, there's no authority in Wisconsin for holding damages against one defendant in a multi-defendant case against the other as a prerequisite for finding punitive damages against a defendant that had no pecuniary damages awarded against him. Second, I think it's dangerous in this case because the damages awarded against the bank, the $385,000, were awarded on a claim of breach of contract, which has, as the court is aware, a lower standard of proof, and that is the lowest standard of proof in the Wisconsin court's preponderance of the evidence. Liability was found against Mr. Belo on the claim of tortious interference with a contract as an intentional tort that carries a higher burden of proof, clear and convincing evidence. And as I mentioned in my brief, that essentially allows Mr. Musso to get punitive damages in through the back door because the jury had to find less strong evidence to find liability against the bank than it did against Mr. Belo. Now, Mr. Duffy made an interesting point, and that is that the reason that the jury didn't simply award those damages against Mr. Belo is because it had already awarded those damages against the bank and was instructed not to duplicate the damages. It's an interesting point, but I think it's contrary to what the jury instruction form in this, or the special verdict form in this case, demonstrates. Now, I admit, reading this special verdict form is a little bit like reading tea leaves, but I think the court has to look at the sequence of the questions in the special verdict form. The questions against Mr. Belo were listed first. Specifically, the jury was asked whether Mr. Belo interfered with the ALU contract. Those questions were asked in sequence. I think there were questions 1 through 6 or 1 through 8 or something like that. Then the jury was asked whether the bank interfered with Mr. ALU's contract. Another 6 or 8 questions. Finally, in that one set of questions about the ALU contract, the jury was asked whether whether the bank breached its duty of good faith with respect to the ALU contract, and it's on that claim that the jury inserted the $385,000 in damages. Now, I think Mr. Duffy might have a stronger argument if the questions relating to Mr. Belo had followed the questions relating to the bank. The bank could have inserted its answer on breach of duty of good faith in its first set of questions and then left out damages against Mr. Belo on tortious interference, and he might have a claim that the jury was simply following the instructions. But here, given the sequence, I think that claim is less strong. If you look at the jury instruction form, as most jury instruction forms do, they have you start out with a question, and then they walk you through it. If you answered question one, yes, go on to question two. If you answer question two, yes, go on to question three. So I don't think that this court can make the logical leap that the jury was leaping around the special verdict form. I think the jury probably did go through the special verdict form question by question. So I don't think Mr. Duffy's argument that the jury was simply honoring the instruction not to duplicate damages, I don't think that argument is very strong in this case. I'm not quite sure where I was going with that.
Could I ask this question? If one could construct a theory of exactly what the jury was doing, that's perfectly logical, but in fact that theory is not fully documented in the special verdict report, would it be your position that the jury just screwed this up and it is beyond repair?
I don't think the jury screwed it up and it's beyond repair. I think there are some problems with interpreting the jury instruction or the special verdict form in the way that Mr. Duffy would urge you to. I think the more reasonable interpretation of the special verdict form is what I've suggested, and that is that the jury simply meant not to award any damages against Mr. Belo for pecuniary damages for breach of, or for intentional interference with the contract. I think there were some problems with the special verdict form and the jury instructions as well. Like Mr. Duffy, I think we did the best we could given the complexity of this case under the circumstances. I see that my time is up. Are there any other questions?
Justice Bradley would like to ask a question.
Did the plaintiff allege in the complaint or pursue at trial the doctrine of respondeat superior?
I believe the plaintiff pursued that argument at trial. In fact, the plaintiff made a motion to have the bank and Mr. Belo held, he'll say it wasn't jointly and severally liable, but vicariously liable on a theory of respondeat superior. He lost that motion.
Who's the he?
The plaintiff. So my reading of that decision, or my reading of the meaning of that decision, is that it means the damages against the bank are the bank's damages, and the damages against Mr. Belo are Mr. Belo's damages. So that issue was raised in the trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Duffy, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'll try to address some of the questions that I heard. Perhaps I can help shed some light. As far as the not having the transcript prepared and the way the Court of Appeals did their two decisions, the transcript was not... Otherwise, I'll be up on my toes all the time. The transcript was not, as I say, relevant to the issue that the trial court decided for, that the Court of Appeals decided the first time. Had Mr. Buell felt that it supported his position in this case, he certainly could have had it prepared. The respondent has every opportunity to supplement the record. We didn't think it was necessary because it was a legal question, and Mr. Buell didn't think it was necessary for whatever reason. The Chief Justice asked some questions about whether you need... my understanding of the question he asked implied that you need emotional distress damages in order to support a punitive damage claim. I don't know if that was correct or not, but that's the impression I got. Let me just tell you what I think and what I think the law is. Any compensatory damages will support a punitive damage award. I don't think anyone disputes that. Even if this award was for plain medical bills and not emotional distress, even in an intentional interference with contract case, those medical bills would be compensatory damages which would support a punitive damage award. I don't think the Court of Appeals was saying you need emotional distress rather than medical bills to support the punitive damage claim. It was just saying we're going to treat medical bills like emotional distress for this substantial other damage requirement.
And they're not okay.
Pardon?
Emotional distress would not be okay as a substantial damage.
As a substantial damage, correct. I think it would be okay to support punitive damages, but that's a separate question. I got the idea that we were putting the two questions together. I just wanted to make sure they were kept apart. I agree with the Chief Justice's concerns about the Anderson case, and I think that this would be an opportune time, should the court decide, to do with intentional torts and emotional distress what it did with negligent torts and emotional distress in the Bowen case. In the Bowen case, the court realized that for 60 years at least, we have been imposing all kinds of artificial requirements before we're going to give them emotional distress, because we don't trust emotional distress claims. You had the zone of danger, you had physical manifestations, some states had the impact rule, etc. The court wisely, I think, said we can trust jurors and we can trust medical science and we can trust jurors to consider medical science. What we're going to do is simply require negligence, cause, and severe emotional distress, and then we can apply public policy if we need to. I don't think there's any reason why the court couldn't do the same thing, clear up the thicket of ambiguities and artificial limitations in the intentional realm by saying what we need is an intentional tort, cause, and a severe emotional response. And if we need to cut off liability in a particular case with public policy, we certainly can. So I think the court could certainly, if the court today agrees with the Court of Appeals that we should treat medical bills like emotional distress, that would certainly give the court the power in this case to make a ruling as far as emotional distress damages, to clear up the confusion. As far as the length of time between treatment and injury, Dr. Marshall, the defense examiner, noted that Mr. Musa said he couldn't get treatment in 1988 after the foreclosure because he couldn't afford it. When he did get the treatment was in 1990 and beyond, and Dr. Marshall confirmed the diagnoses as depression and anxiety, and Mr. Musa attributed that all to the foreclosure from the bank. So I think there is a change. As far as why the jury put $385,000 for the bank instead of Bulow, maybe it thought it had more money. It wanted the bank to get hit for the $385,000 because they were hitting Bulow for the $50,000 since he was the guy who did all the actions. We don't know and we'll never know why the jury did what it did. All I'm saying is they followed the instructions they had. They gave the $385,000 and they couldn't repeat it anywhere else.
Mr. Duffy.
Yes, sir.
How do you think if you were writing this opinion, how would you write it? Just outline it. What would you say?
Well, I know that the law favors deciding the case on the narrowest grounds possible. I think the court would be perfectly justified in saying that the way the law stands today, emotional distress is emotional distress, medical bills are medical bills, and we're not going to apply an emotional distress rule to medical bills.
So you would say there's medical bills, that's substantial damage, and that can hold the weight for the punitive damage. Punitive damages can be rested on, and that's the narrowest holding.
That would be the narrowest, and that's the way I would write it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I assume you disagree, so I understand that, Mr. Neumeier. That concludes 98-2738, Musa versus...